right? Synchronic might be like, let's look at this little moment in time. It is what it is. What came before doesn't matter. What comes after doesn't matter. And the reality is that part of the reason that the power of now is so seductive for us is because we're missing that nutrient. As a culture, we're terrible at just being. We took some hits, man. This wasn't fun. I might have had much higher status, right? We cashed all that in to come and risk being vulnerable in transit and vulnerable setting up, building, rebuilding from scratch so that our kids or our grandkids.
I'm just really in that moment. And it seems like a lot of what you're suggesting is putting people in that state. Well, the book is presented is that the world is on fire and that we've kind of lost all meaning. What is the issue? Like, what did you see happening in the world, particularly that made you inspired to write this book? Like, why is it that we've lost so much meaning in the world?
Well, I mean, good Lord, you know, like that is a lifetime of academic research and inquiry. But in the sort of the TLDR of it, right, is that we are suffering from a meaning crisis. And you can slice and dice that 1,000 ways, but a simple way to describe it is that we, you know, our shared worldview, say post-World War II, mostly developed world and kind of perpetuate, you know, permeating elsewhere, has been formed by the two pillars of traditional religion, kind of meaning 1.0, which is how almost all humans for almost all of human history have organized, who am I? Where am I? How does this world work? How ought I live? Right? What is truth? Right? So that's meaning 1.0. And on
that's
the other
side, traditional religion, you're saying, right? Like,
yeah,
organized
traditional
religion.
Faith-based. This is what your priest, your rabbi, your imam, right? Your shaman would have said, here's who you are, cupcake, and here's how to straighten up and fly right. Right. So that was our orienting kind of lighthouse or anchor. And then on the other side, slightly more recently, you could sort of mark it from the European Enlightenment in the 18th century onwards, but definitely picking up lots of steam in the 20th century and even more after World War II to now is kind of modern liberalism. You know, and I don't mean lefty Democrat liberalism, but just kind of classical liberalism, the idea of civil rights and democracy and markets and all of those kinds of things. And the idea that sort of, you know, meritocratic science and evidence-based, you know, secular society, right? And those two pillars, meaning 1.0, traditional religion, and meaning 2.0, modern liberalism, kind of held up the big tent. And we all lived inside it. And you could have a conservative political party. You could have a progressive political party. They would agree to kind of play fairly on the battlefield of voters. And, you know, and this is the thing. And we were always generally moving forward towards a more equitable, more just, more inclusive, more globally connected humanist social project together, right? With lots of caveats, lots of failed enterprises, lots of contradictions. But that was generally the shared story. And if you wanted, and if you kind of lost the plot, you could tune into one of three channels on your television, because there were only three channels to tune into, you know, and you had the Walter Cronkites narrating the Vietnam War. You had, you know, you had the Peter Jennings and the Tom Brokaws. You had these sort of trusted news voices. You had the Financial Times, you had the Wall Street Journal, you had the New York Times. And that was sort of considered polite opinion as to what was really going on. And we've seen both of those. We've seen meaning 1.0 crumble and collapse with everything from the church crises and scandals and that kind of loss of the sort of moral authority of those institutions, yeah, all the way to just a bunch more people choosing to disengage and decouple from the faith of their families and their ancestors and just being like,
when
I'm
do you
spiritual
think that started mother. Happening? Like, when did the shift from traditional? Would you say like it's science? As science became more mainstream? And people were started to be more educated in science from an early age, that new generation that grew up learning science and are now probably in their, you know, baby boomers or even the millennials even. Do you think that's kind of when that shift happened, when education from an early age started introducing science, or were there different factors that implemented or accelerated that?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a beautiful, nuanced, complex, you know, multi-generational process. But sure. I think factors that you can say are for sure in the mix, right? One, you know, if you take a look at it from sort of within the inquiry of like religiosity, like why do people believe what they believe, and why should we care, and how do people sort of stop believing a little less? One is you could just say, hey, most organized mainline faiths, meaning the big institutions, the ones with lots of buildings and lots of money and lots of infrastructure, have been slow to change and keep up with a modern and rapidly evolving world. And even just things like same-sex marriage, right? Birth control, like various things where even a bunch of particularly, you know, Western European and American Catholics are like, yeah, I'm not living my life based on exactly what the priest tells me or exactly what the Pope has said is kosher and not kosher, right? I have gay friends or I'm gay. I'm using birth control because I don't want seven kids, you know, like various sort of just decouplings from doctrine to modern secular life and life choices. So there's a whole kind of stack of that. There's also an increase in a yearning, craving, and just broad availability of direct experiential spirituality. Right. So if I'm going to, you know, we'll use kind of, you know, Protestant or even Catholic Christian churches as just a default example here. But if like I'm going to church and I've got smells and bells, you know, you got your choir boys and you're burning funny incense and ringing the little bells and you're kneeling and genuflecting and all you get is a little wafer and a sip of wine. And that's the closest to God you get, right? People are just not that moved by that. When I could go to Electric Daisy Carnival and pop down 150 milligrams of MDMA and like shoot the moon, you know, I'm like, I'm going there, thanks, right? And so that, and I say that kind of glibly, but it's actually, it's a legitimate bifurcation as far as generational seeking. And by the way, that's also a profoundly American tradition, which is like the Great Awakenings, which happened in the, you know, the 1800s and then the early 19th century, were full-on throwdowns. They're like, hey, our parents are stuffy and stodgy and they've dropped the plot. They're just going through the motions in their churches. We want to blow out the pipes and have direct experiential connection and communion with each other and with the Holy Spirit. And oh, by the way, those experiences galvanize us so much that we then support suffragettes, we support women's rights, we support abolition and equal rights. We, you know, they seeded a whole bunch of social justice movements as well, like centuries ago. So like on the, you know, you could say, oh, kids these days, but on the other hand, right, what we're seeing in this move towards direct experiential sort of leaderless communion or direct spiritual experience is actually centuries old. And a very particular American experience. And, you know, and then you can also just say, you know, like I said, the collapse in moral authority of a lot of these institutions of like, oh, whoa, you were supposed to be keeping us safe. You were supposed to be the shepherd. You're actually barbecuing the sheep. And so that had, you know, those two combinations, changes in religiosity, keeping up with secular values or not, right? And then the erosion of the moral authority, I think, are all contributing factors. And then so what's the net result is that mainline religious institutions are just aging out. It's just the blue-haired church ladies. They're the only ones still going. And interestingly, some of the only growth industry places are Pentecostal and evangelicals. So like the booming megachurch. Well, because they're more experiential. It's Jesus rock. Right. It's straight up electrified. It's rock and roll shows. If you look at like where, you know, Justin Bieber and, you know, and the Kardashians, right, and all the NBA players went, they went to Hillsong, which has subsequently gone down in scandal and flames. But I mean, if you looked at a Hillsong, you know, like shots from a Hillsong service on a Sunday in New York or LA, it's indistinguishable from a Diplo concert. I mean, there's fog machines, there's lasers, there's all the things, and it's post-denominational, right? They're not saying we're Southern Baptist or we're, you know, or we're Pentecostal. They're just like, we're just Jesus people. We're just here for the Lord, right? And it's everybody, you know, all the kids from Brooklyn and their broad-brimmed felt hats, and it's styly and it's vibey, although the doctrine, interestingly enough, remains super traditional. So they're quite often not accepting of gay communities. They're quite often like, so there's this sort of big, broad, inclusive net. But when you really get down to the fine print, they're actually still peddling some pretty retro codes and sort of moralities.
You got to wonder, like, how many of those people that actually attend these things are there only for the experience and the community that they get from being, you know, belonging from other people versus actually believing in a lot of the things that they're teaching in terms of the older doctrines, particularly around the things that are very controversial, right?
I think you just nailed it. I think that's a huge number, because I remember there was one, I think, Vanity Fair article as the Hillsong scandals were kind of building, and there was a closeted gay Hillsong community member, like someone who was actually active in doing like stuff, right, on the team. And he just flipped open his Grindr app, and the place was lousy with like co-located folks on the Grindr app, right, which is a gay dating app, right? Yeah. And of course, everybody there had to be closeted. So this is kind of what some of these sort of irreconcilable differences, right, as to how that's all going. But you know,
was that the scandal? Is that the main scandal?
No. It was just that the rock and the sort of hype priest preachers who are wearing, you know, $300 jeans and Yeezys and the whole bit, you know, and piercings and leather jackets, right? Those guys, the power went to their heads. They ended up having affairs. They ended up dealing with financial abuse, dysfunctional things with their, you know, bullying their staffs, whatever. And so that's all gone, decidedly pear-shaped. But that's also indicative, right, of just what happens when you play with ecstatic states, you play with deep healing, and you do it in connections with others or community. You end up with cultic tendencies when we're monkeying with these psychotechnologies at scale.
Yeah. There was this black preacher that just came on the news who convinced people to, like, the church gave him like something around tax evasion, but he had like a private jet.
Oh yeah.
And like it was $65 million that he was evading, or he got from the church or something like that. Like, how does that even happen? I don't understand how people get into a situation like that where he can benefit from something like that. It's crazy to me.
And I mean, there's one preacher, if you've ever seen the, I think it's the Mighty Gemstones or the Righteous Gemstones, I always get confused, but it's an HBO show with John Goodman and then Danny, what's his bucket, the Eastbound and Down guy. It's a hilarious show of like three generations of mega preachers, and they just take the piss out of this whole scene. But there's an actual real mega preacher who was like, you know, you need to call in right now and give me donations so that I can buy my even bigger jet. And because I'm closer to Jesus up at 35,000 feet, so he can hear me pray better. Right. So just shameless. Right. But actually, you know, back to the kind of anthropological lens, you're like, oh, how on earth did we get to this? And you realize, wow, the prosperity gospel. Right. So church has always been phenomenal. Right. Phenomenal at raising money. Because, and in fact, you know, we live here in Austin, Texas, so it's both a sort of little progressive bubble, but it is also Texas, and there are some of the largest mega churches around here, and right on the corner of our street. We've lived here for 10 years, and it was just this church, and then they added a preschool, and then they added a K-6, and then they added a K-12, and then they added a cafe, and then they added more buildings, and then they added parking, and then they added and realized, oh my gosh, not only were they just blowing up, but they were then doing roll-ups. They were doing aggressive, basically venture capital roll-ups of all the other underperforming churches, buying them up. And then that became like the mothership. And every Sunday they would broadcast from there to live stream to all their other churches. And then the police are even like stopping traffic on Sunday mornings to create their own stoplights for all the people to come and go from this mega church. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is fascinating, because how are these guys able to grow? Well, fundamentally, they're getting interest-free money from their congregation. And if you think back to the Catholic Church, right, it became the largest, wealthiest landholder in Europe over the centuries, all that kind of stuff, consolidated power, because they basically said, give us your money, tithe, right? Give us 1/10 of your income in exchange for your mortal soul. Right. That's a very strong value proposition.
Pretty good deal. Yeah.
But what American megachurches did was they said, give us 10% or more of your money. And it's not just in exchange for your mortal soul after you die. Right. The prosperity gospel wiggled it, this little snippet of code, which was saying, actually, if you give us money now, you will be blessed in this lifetime with material abundance. You can have your cake and eat it, friends, if you only open your checkbook now. And the more you give me, the more that's going to come back to you. And this is very Calvinist. If you go back to, you know, like Protestant theology, this is by their fruits ye shall know them, right? Which is that material abundance and actually consumer prosperity are signs of God's favor in this lifetime. Not that the meek shall inherit the earth, right? But that if you give us the money, you'll make bank also. And that is like crack cocaine to an American consumer identity. It's not just, I'll give you money for my eventual salvation in the next life. I'll give you money as a down payment on my baller best life. yeah. in this life.
In addition to that, the churches don't have to pay any taxes, right?
Oh, God, no.
So, like, how did that happen? Like, and how are we still not questioning this with people that are in politics that, I guess, are, like, not religious, but obviously they have to say they're religious to get the votes, but... is that just like the politics game that we've just run in a circle where they have to pretend they believe in God or just to get the votes, and it just never really
sure. I mean,
reversed?
I mean, at this point, this is just grandfathered pork barrel projects, right? Yeah. They're on the books, and the people who have benefited from them have continued to grease the skids of the political system. So no one is willing to shut them off, even though the time is probably well past that. And so for people that we know, like in the psychedelics community, there's obviously like kind of the medicalization route, like, you know, this is going through the FDA and approvals and doctor, you know, approved for trauma and depression and that kind of stuff. And then there's the other pathway, which is religious acts, like the Native American Church and the Supreme Court justifying that, hey, if you're doing it for a religious purpose, you're kind of exempt from scheduled controlled substance use, et cetera. And there's a bunch of people being like, oh, we're going to start our own psychedelic church. And then they write up these grand flowery manifestos about, like, we commit to worship the universe, and we're going to get in touch with the feminine and reintegrate the masculine and whatever their particular version is. And my advice to them is always like, don't do that. Don't do that at all. You'll get murdered, right? Like, you'll get dismantled in the courts and shut down. You'll be like, you're just a bunch of tripping hippies. We're coming to bust you anyway, right? What they should actually do is they should take the charter from, like, Joel Osteen's megachurch in Houston and just do find replace on a handful of words and run the exact same charter so that if the federal government comes to shut them down, you're going to overturn the precedent that actually upholds all the right wing mega churches as well.
That's smart.
Then you've got some buffer, right? Because as you said, there's all these deeply entrenched interests at this point. And, you know, and I think a lot of those original rulings, I mean, I would have to go back to see the case law and the precedent, but my assumption is that many of those rulings are early 20th century, you know, like pre-50s. So that's pre-Tammy Faye Baker. That's pre, you know, Jerry Falwell. That's pre the kind of rise of the prosperity gospel mega preacher. So back then, it was just kind of separation of church and state, and churches kind of get some preferential treatment because they're not really in the marketplace, right? They're just barely scraping by, not daddy's got a jet and a big ass mansion, you know? So we've seen that kind of subversion of that. And of course, all of that does percolate down to what do young people choose to do? And do they find communities of faith that feel resonant, or do they find spiritual but not religious community in transformational dance culture, in Burning Man, in some other emergent, you know, cultural mutation versus mainline religion?
Yeah, it seems like we're still in this transition period. I mean, most of my friends that I know are, you know, are agnostic or atheist. And it seems like a lot of people had parents that were religious. So, like, my parents were Catholic, and I was born, with baptism. Like, I had no real choice, you know what I mean? Like, it was just kind of what we're brought to us. And then obviously with information that I got from peers and so forth, you know, people change their minds as they grow up. Do you think it's information access that also accelerated this, as before 20, 30 years ago, with very little internet access, a lot of people just knew what people around them or their local newspapers had information to, and they didn't really know what was out there, all these scandals that were happening in the religious movements? But now with information, do you think that just accelerated everything, basically, that allowed people to be more aware of what's actually happening around there?
I mean, for sure, unfiltered, not sort of centrally controlled media access, just access to more information has let a lot of pennies drop, you know, where you're like, oh, whoa, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. Like, this is not cool. So there's that. But there is also a wild broadening of access to options in the spiritual marketplace. So if somebody had any yearning for something more in the 20th century, you know, let's just say loosely up to this, you know, this mid-60s, your really only place to go look for salvation, for inspiration, for transcendence was some form of organized religion. And now, you know, think back to Oprah, you know, hosting Eckhart Tolle, right? I mean, Eckhart Tolle was like homeless on a park bench for a few years. And the next thing you know, he's hosting the largest spiritual gathering on Oprah for like, that's I don't crazy. Know what it was, 70 or 80 million people simulcast. And you're like, whoa. And this is some dude who's speaking about like non-dual awareness, the power of now, like very, you know, otherwise heretical to esoteric concepts that have been completely mainstreamed. And now you can just thumb scroll through Instagram and there's every single Instagram shaman, lifestyle guru, download the source codes to your wealth codes, like get in touch with your star family, get in touch with Ramtha, some channeling. I mean, it's just, it's just yeah. everywhere with no yeah. filter and no quality control. And, you know, not to beat the drum on the theme, but also highly commodified. There's almost always someone on the make. And Tim Wu, who is a Columbia law professor, one of the smartest kind of just voices out there in the world right now, just as far as like what he keeps his finger on. He was the coiner of the original term back in like 2001 or 2003 of net neutrality, right? He was like early internet. He's like, hey, I think we really have to keep this Switzerland, right? This shouldn't be preferential pay-to-play treatment, those kind of things. He was way ahead of the curve on that. And he also wrote a book about basically 20th century marketing, right? And how did we get to this crazy consumer, this hyper-consumer society, of which, right, that prosperity gospel, like if you give tons of money, you get tons of shit back and you get to live your best life and drive a nice car and live in a sweet place and thank you, baby Jesus, right? Like that, in his telling of the story, he's like, you know, modern marketing as we know it, like what gave us Don Draper and Mad Men, right, in the 50s in Madison Avenue, actually started with, honest to God, snake oil salesmen and failed evangelical preachers. The three dudes that were the founders, that were the godfathers of the DNA of modern marketing, were all spinning snake oil religious redemption narratives. And they realized that it didn't just have to be on Sunday mornings, and the product wasn't a full collection plate. The product could be Listerine. In fact, if you've ever heard the phrase, always a bridesmaid, never a bride, right? Like that comment, right? Like there's a sort of a poor woman who's always invited to her friend's wedding, but never gets married herself. That was actually a Listerine commercial in the 20s. And Listerine, right? That horrendous, like golden, tastes like ass mouthwash, right? Was actually an antiseptic for Civil War battle wounds. And in the 1920s, Listerine was like, there's no more battles. What do we do? How do we sell our stuff? So they're like, oh, well, actually, maybe it'll kill stuff in your mouth. Why would anybody do it? It tastes like ass. Let's coin the term chronic halitosis. Didn't exist. We're going to tell you this new technical sounding term, and then we're going to sell you the solution to it. And always a bridesmaid, never a bride was this entire conversation about this poor girl who gets invited to weddings and has bad breath. And that's how they then peddled Listerine. And now fill in the blank all the way to Prozac, all the way to restless leg syndrome, all the way to every single symptom we're ever told. And it's not just that we're being sold solutions to our problems. We are being enrolled in a redemption narrative. You fell from grace. You became fat, pale, ugly, poor, bad breath, dandruff, whatever it might be. Here is your ta-da redemption story. And if you only kneel down, say the catechism, buy the thing, then you will be redeemed and live happily ever after, just like all those people playing volleyball in the Coors Light commercial.
Yeah. Do you think another part of that is that those guys back in the day were tapping into something that is so rooted in human needs and psychology, which is the sense of belonging and community and meaning? And really, they were just trying to, you know, take advantage of that for their own purpose, similar to how most people talk about running tech companies or any kind of brand is all about building the community, needing to belong, a sense of purpose. And it really hasn't changed that much. I mean, that sense of purpose has gone from religion now to, you know, a products or Elon Musk, you know, where you're a Tesla owner now and you're part of this community. It's all kind of the same thing. It's just one from religion to product, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, Bernays, like the founder of modern propaganda theory. There's all these kind of, you know, contributions, and it's a somewhat of an unholy cocktail because it basically hoodwinked us, caused us to fracture and fragment our actual community ties, our human stuff of relatedness and interdependence and place-based identity, right? I mean, I was in some conversations with some Maori in New Zealand, and they would open up every gathering with like, I am so-and-so, here is my mountain, this is my river, these are my people, that's who I am. Not click on my LinkedIn, or slide into my DMs to see how many followers I have, right? I am from this place. This is where the water comes from. This is the high ground. This is my clan or tribe. And that's how we all used to locate ourselves. And so we've gone from, if you think of kind of like, you know, all the recent research in the last 10 years of like how interconnected forests are, right? They're like, oh, trees aren't just individual trees. Trees have their roots and then they interconnect and communicate with each other. And then there's all these mycelial networks, all the mushrooms and the fungal connections. And it's like an underground brain and the whole forest is interacting and supporting each other. And when there's a sick one, they shunt chlorophyll and energy to, you know, even an albino tree, like albino redwoods exist, which shouldn't, they should just die because they cannot, they cannot commit photosynthesis, but they're interconnected and the other trees help them. Trees at the bottom of a drainage close to a creek will literally shunt water uphill to their cousins that are at the top of the hill who can't get their roots there. And if there's a bug or a virus on the edge of the forest, then it instantly communicates through it. And trees on the other side of the forest will start generating antibodies. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. So that's how we used to be interconnected, interdependent. And now we're all potted plants, you know, on the shelf in the gardening section at Home Depot. Like we're wrapped in plastic. Our root balls don't connect to anything. They're just stuck growing in on themselves. And we have to get artificial water and artificial nutrients, right? Because we're not in the earth anymore. And that is a direct result, I would suggest, right, of this isolated, fragmented consumer society, of which, by the way, all biohacking and all personal growth is a direct subset. It skips out on the Jesus part. But even those original snake oil salesmen, I mean, what did they do in the 19th century when they were like going through the Wild West with their little wagons? They always had a secret ingredient, a magical secret ingredient that was supposed to do the whiz bang thing. And if you look at everybody's formulations now of like the ultimate limitless pills and this and that, they all have the secret ingredient. I mean, it's laughable how much of a carbon copy it is and how little that story has changed. But I think the biggest thing to what you're saying is that we are potted plants now, not members of a forest community. And that accounts for a huge amount. I mean, Vivek Murthy, right, the U.S. Surgeon General, has written a book called Together, and it's fundamentally about our loneliness epidemic. And that is an enormous, enormous, you know, sort of unintended slash kind of engineered consequence of being forever messaged as fractured, isolated, egotistical consumer zoo animals. Yeah. Like, I've got problems. I should press a button, buy a thing, and I've been conditioned to expect, and I've been promised that if I buy the thing, the product, the good, or the service, I'm going to get relief slash transcendence now. And if I don't, I'm going to be pissed off, and I'm going to pull a Karen, and I'm going to want to call the manager and complain about it. And that is a very fragile human psyche, right? Yeah. Versus the kind of stoic, connected, willing to endure the tough stuff on behalf of our kids, you know, like the kind of way any immigrant community has. I mean, think about any immigrant experience. I'm imagining maybe were your parents born in the US or did they immigrate here?
Yeah, we were all born in Korea and then we immigrated.
Okay. And my parents moved from Africa and England to here, you know, so I mean, you know, a relatively easy road compared to folks from other places, still, you know, English native language, that kind of stuff. But even so, right, there's always the stories of, we took some hits, man. This wasn't fun. I might have had much higher status, educational credentialing, whatever, in my country of origin, right? We cashed all that in to come and risk being vulnerable in transit and vulnerable setting up, building, rebuilding from scratch so that our kids or our grandkids could have a better shot at the good life, right? Mm-hmm. That's this profound story of hope, but it's intergenerational suffering. And these days we've been largely disconnected from that. And I think that's, you know, looking forward into the world ahead, right? I think it's a key part of us reconnecting to intergenerational consciousness and dedication versus I've been conditioned to expect to get all mine in this lifetime right away in 6 minutes or less.
So the transition that happened from meaning 1.0 to 2.0, you're saying we just kind of went too far the other way. And now we're missing out on the kind of the original community part and that meaning and the purpose part that did come from meaning 1.0, but obviously that was also missing some elements. So talk to us about this, like what went wrong when we made that transition And, you know, now we can, and then we can kind of go forward into what Meaning 3.0, as you describe in the book, is about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, if you think of the sort of the group that was called the New Atheists, right, back in the early 2000s, it was when Sam Harris first blew up, right? He wrote The End of Faith, and he had that conversation with Christopher Hitchens, the English, well-known, you know, hilarious, cynical atheist, Richard Dawkins, and a few other people, right, the biologist. And at that point, they could see this coming. They could see this collapse in organized religion. This was the rise of the nones, like spiritual but not religious. I checked the box of like none of the above. And they were like, yay, good riddance to bad rubbish. You know, religion's the opiate of the masses. Religion is infantilizing. Religion has all these whack ass just so stories that, you know, any reasonable, you know, credible person would just dismiss out of hand. It's all bullshit. And good for us humans, we're growing out of it. But what they missed was that people belonging to communities of faith in general, and this is around the world, and it's independent of your deity or your creed. So it doesn't matter who you believe in is upstairs or running the show. It's just that you believe in is the key factor that matters. And they've found that the people who are active participants in communities of faith are generally healthier, wealthier, and happier than people who don't. So you're like, okay, fascinating. So Meaning 1.0, you can do the whole critique of it, right? But on the other hand, it wouldn't have persisted if it hadn't served a really important pro-social set of values. And health, wealth, and happiness are right up there, right? It works. So I think it's really important to honor and acknowledge what our ancestors got right, right? And it's fundamentally the access, and this is the Harvard Sacred Design Lab did studies on that. And they basically came up with the three of the essential nutrients, right, that mattered the most were healing, inspiration, and connection. Mm. Right. The idea that inspiration, you go into a cathedral or a church with stained glass, you hear the big organs, you sing the hymns, they sort of elevate your spirit and acquaint you with awe. And again, think back to the origins of that technology, right? Let's say medieval, you know, the Gothic cathedrals, right? Basically, indistinguishable, beautiful stained glass, because I mean, most windows were tiny and dull, and there wasn't a lot of light inside people's buildings. So colored stained glass of amazing saints and pictures, you know, iconic pictures, amazing. Big giant pipe organs, right? Rumbling through the stone and reverberating sound waves. It's indistinguishable from a laser show with a Function One sound system at an EDM concert. We've just replicated that shit, right? Mm-hmm. Colored lights, awe, and thumping bass. So we used to do all those things. That was inspiration, right? And then healing, like I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see, right? Like those moments of acknowledging that life's a bitch and then we die. And I've taken some hits along the way. So I drag my broke ass self to a service, a ceremony. And I realize I'm not alone. There's other people. And, you know, and I would say the, you know, Black Southern Baptist churches were just off the charts in the sort of emotive, like, amen. Can I get an amen? Oh, yes. You know, the speaking in tongues, the collapsing, the fainting, like catharting, yeah. Right? I'm working out the kinks of my life, right? I'm testifying with my grief. And then in praise and joy. And of course, we're not doing this in a closet. We're doing this with the throng, the multitude. We're doing this with our brothers and sisters. We're doing this with the congregation. And that cycle, healing, inspiration, connection, you know, seems to be essential nutrients for our health and our vitality and our ability to go on through a world that's not always kind, that's not always fair, that's not always easy.
Yeah.
And so that's really essential stuff. So basically, religion or Meaning 1.0, right, promised salvation, right? You can know where you're going to go and you're going to be safe and looked after in the sweet by and by, right? In the sweet hereafter, right? But at the cost of inclusion. If you believed in what we believed, if you worship our gods, you're saved. If you don't, you weren't. You were a pagan, you were a heretic, you were an apostate, right? You were somebody who was subhuman and not entitled to the same privileges. Right. So Meaning 1.0 was salvation at the cost of inclusion. Then we pivoted. You get into the French Enlightenment. You get into Nietzsche saying God is dead. You get into secular humanism. And that offered inclusion. It offered exactly the opposite. It offered inclusion. Everybody's welcome, regardless of race, color, or creed, at the cost of salvation. No one's going to tell you about God. No one's going to assert a single higher purpose or point. So we have salvation at the cost of inclusion or inclusion at the cost of salvation, both partial. So the question now becomes, what might meaning 3.0 look like? Which is, can we offer inclusive salvation? Can we offer the healing, inspiration, and connection to everybody without somebody sitting at the top, a pope, a bishop, an imam, whomever, dictating what you're supposed to believe? Can we do kind of, what is the blockchain, right, of conscious culture? Can we offer the building blocks? Can we offer the Lego pieces that everybody can assemble for themselves, for their own communities of practice, things that feel right and true and good for them? But back to that neuroanthropology experiment, we know this shit works. We know these Lego blocks, when you click them together, actually do the thing. So that's the potential project of meaning 3.0.
I can really resonate with what you're saying about healing and connection. Like, and it's a lot of it is this technological. I mean, there's also culture. Like, I don't come from a background, particularly like in Korea or Japan, where the idea of therapy is I think it's still seen as a very negative connotation, like to admit weakness, men shouldn't cry, all of these different things where they don't even have a community. And you're talking about like the highest, one of the highest suicide rates in these countries. And we're connecting now.
Are they higher than US rates?
Japan, I think, is pretty high. Like they have, they even have like a suicide forest over there. Like it's pretty bad. And a lot of it is because of the fact that there's no real community to talk around this kind of stuff with. I mean, globally as well, right? We're placed in these small little rectangle devices that we have where we're stuck on Instagram or YouTube where people are presenting their best lives, but it's also the way that we're supposed to be communicating. This is how most people communicate. We don't call each other anymore. People text, people message each other on Instagram where the only thing they see is people living their best lives. So they don't feel like they need to communicate or to talk about their vulnerabilities because it's all under one company, right? That is designed to share only the best things. It's all real backwards in that sense. So yeah, it's no wonder. But you're talking about now salvation, where there is no big person on the top that people look up to. But do you think, like, humans as in general, like, do you think most humans though need something or someone to look up to just as humans in general?
I mean, fundamentally, I think you can make the case that it seems that way, right? Ernest Becker won a Pulitzer for his book, The Denial of Death, right? Which is basically kind of like most human philosophy, culture, civilization. It's just us trying to wrestle with life's a bitch and then we die. And we are time traveling monkeys, man. We know that fact ahead of dying. Right. I mean, most animals, we presume, don't have advanced notice of their own mortality. They're just living until they're suddenly not. Right. And it's that foresight that is the human existential condition.
Right.
And so how do we do this? Right. And you can make a case, right, that and our buddy Brian Mararescu, he wrote a book called The Immortality Key, right, which was very, popular a couple of years ago, and it was fundamentally making the case that the ancient Greek mystery traditions, specifically the Eleusinian mysteries, actually carried through into early Christianity. And he just unpacks this whole notion of like death, rebirth, initiation rituals. And I think, it's one of the Greeks that said, die before you die, right? Like that's the secret to life. And Plato talked about the Eleusinian mysteries as like, it's the high pinnacle achievement of Greek civilization. And it seeded all of our culture, all of our ethics, all of our philosophy, music and art, right? Was this mystical initiation to have a death rebirth experience in your lifetime.
Hmm. And how would that work? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Oh,
like
for sure.
Die before you die.
Yeah. But I mean, and I'll even just add another quote, just because this is not just Plato and it's not just Eleusis. It was Goethe, right? He said, he who doesn't know the secret, die and become, shall remain forever a stranger on this earth. So fundamentally, death, rebirth, initiation rituals are as ancient as human civilization. Shamanic initiations were almost always near-death experiences. Right, you would go out, you would fast, you'd be tossed out naked into the wilderness to survive on your own wits. You'd hook down some crazy potion that was slightly too seriously poisonous, and it might kill you if it didn't deliver you divine visions. All of these kinds of things, right? The Spartans used to whip the living shit out of their boys, like literally beat them unconscious, and they were supposed to, for the honor of their family, not cry out, right? And afterwards, they were welcomed in. The Vikings, you know, had the sort of Odin was nailed to the world tree for 9 days and nine nights in order to discern the secrets of Valhalla. And so their priests would do the same, right? There's all of these wild ass, the sundance, the Lakota sundance ceremony being suspended by your flesh, you know, for multiple days until you entered a trance and received visions. There's always been hardcore life death initiation rituals. And they didn't always, you know, they didn't always hinge on physical, you know, mutilation and actual physiological near-death experiences. Sometimes they were drug-induced, right? Sometimes the death experience would be a psychedelic ego death experience, or it could be some super intensive fasting, sleeplessness, meditation, drumming, chanting, whatever. There's lots of techniques of ecstasy, as Mircea Eliade used to call them, right? So there's lots of different ways to do it, but fundamentally, it would be an experience that prompts, whether it's literal physical or psychological and physiological, near death. And the closest signature to that is your brain waves slowing all the way down from agitated beta, where we are talking and listening, down into alpha, the beginnings of kind of calm and potentially kind of flow states, deeper down into theta, that kind of hypnagogic state where we're drifting off into sleep. Or if you're a disciplined meditator, you don't go to sleep, you actually ride that wave all the way down into delta waves, which is literally like, you know, 0.5 to 4 hertz. It's almost flatlining, right? And our buddy at Stanford, Andrew Huberman, who many people may be familiar with and follow, right? He's even adapted yoga nidra, right, which is dream meditation, into what is he calling it? Non-sleep deep rest. So he's just secularized it, right, into NSDR, and which is basically, can you get into that hypnagogic state where I'm almost asleep but not, you know, just lights out, and can I ride that wave down into delta, right? And
then you're just hypnotizing yourself. That's the same state of being hypnotized.
I'm less familiar with the fine-grained details of hypnotism, but I would for sure imagine that it absolutely involves some drop out of beta into some of these other zones, depending on, I think there's probably as many hypnotherapeutic technologies as there are, you know, as there are people practicing it. There's probably, it's the same. There's no such singular thing as meditation. I mean, there's Dzogchen, Tibetan, there's Vipassana, there's all sorts of different ones, and they actually do different things, and there's different neurophysiological markers of what they do. But the point being is that now we've just established die before you die. That's a good thing. Die before you die has been around for all of human history. It's arguably been the place that people are fundamentally initiated into fully mature human experience. And I think part of why that's so crucial, right? So the die before you, you know, it basically being born again, right? Which shows up in the Christian tradition, although usually the ritual is pretty weak. You know, it's like, do you feel the call? Come on up front, you know, flail around. Everybody hugs you. Yay, you're born again, right? But it wasn't really. There was no precipitating psychotechnology to actually make that a real event. It's a lot of emoting, but not necessarily real transforming in most cases.
And right? that experience, is it as important to have done it where everyone else in a group or a community that you're about to initiate into has also done it? Or is it really just more of like something that you can do for yourself? Like I'm asking because like a lot of these communities, even for myself or others, I'm sure, is like when you go through a hardship with someone, you have that connection with them. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's really the main purpose of it, or is it also just for your own self?
Well, I mean, this goes back to the potted plant versus the tree in a forest. Right. Yes, we can do these things by ourselves, and they will have, you know, X units of value and meaning and potentially healthy integration. But if we, and this is especially true for secular seekers involved in transformative dance culture, psychedelics, all these things. A lot of people are just winging it. They're like, I'm just going to hook down a bunch of drugs and we're going to go see our favorite DJ and cool shit's going to happen, I hope. right? And then they go home on Monday morning and they're like, my apartment sucks and my job sucks and I don't know how to keep this going. And I felt like last night I loved everybody and everything was possible. And today I'm in the suicide Wednesdays. I mean, I'm like despondent and I can't figure out the rest of my life. And this gap between the light I saw on that when I was teleported up to the mountaintop is so different than the dark I live in day to day that I don't know how to join the two. And so it's quite often I'll get stuck in like an addictive compulsive loop of like, when's the next festival? When's the next, who's got the better drug? I've heard about 5-MeO. I've heard about toad licking. Can I go lick a toad? I think that's, I've heard that's rad. Can I get down to Peru? No, I can't get to Peru, but I heard there's a work, you know, there's someone's doing an ayahuasca ceremony. He's like, and they just become hungry ghosts seeking the next high because the last one didn't stick. So, you know, in the big picture, and this kind of ties up everything we've been talking about, our search for meaning, is that, you know, you can make a case that firstborn humans, right? All of us who haven't had that death rebirth experience, we were just born once. And by and large, we didn't choose it. I mean, unless you have some personal belief system around reincarnation and souls choosing to incarnate or whatever, if you're not down that path, you're like, hey, I didn't choose to be born. Just two random humans got together and swapped genetic material and I popped out. And we go from this beautiful experience in the womb, right? By and large, we're warm, we're safe, we're supported, we're nurtured, right? And then, bazam, painful contractions and spat out into this cold, dark, cold, bright, loud world, right? And at some point, and now if we're lucky, you know, if we have a beautiful, connected, stable family that our mothers are able to bring us forth, we might even keep that womb-like experience through early childhood. You know, we might even keep it through high school. At some point, though, we get kicked out of the literal or metaphorical bubble of safety and security. And we get spat out into that harsh, cold, uncaring world. And shit doesn't always work for us, right? So that's, so the pre-tragic phase of life is we're in the womb and we're safe and everything's going to work out. And then we get spat out into this world that is harsh and unfair, cold and uncaring. You know, you scroll through your feeds and you're like, oh my gosh, what's happening with the Uyghurs? Oh my Lord, look at what's happening in Ukraine. Look at George Floyd. Look at the injustice. Look at the pain. How, why? I didn't want this, by the way. I didn't fucking sign up for this, right? And so we often seek transcendence. We seek to try and get back to that womb. We're like, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to do personal growth. I'm going to check out spirituality. I'm going to check out substances. I'm going to check out sexuality. I'm going to check out online. I'm going to do whatever I can to transcend or bypass this life because I didn't fucking actually sign up for it the first time. And there's resentment, there's dislocation. I don't feel at home in my skin and I don't feel that this world makes sense. So then, and that's the power of this death rebirth ritual, right? If we are blessed, if we are fortunate enough to have that kind of opportunity, right? Then we get to do the Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. We get to do the Ebenezer Scrooge, right? We even get to do the kind of Jimmy Stewart in A Wonderful Life, right? And so we have all these stories, right? We have the story of everybody who comes close to the edge and it's like, oh my gosh, I'm about to lose everything, right? I'm about to die. And I choose this life. For the first time in my life, I actually realize that there's no place like home. I actually realize that I matter. I actually realize that that has been a gift all along. I've been staring in the face and now I choose it. And that transformative moment of saying, I choose this life. I'm no longer seeking to transcend it, to bypass it, or to escape it. I actually understand the stakes and I understand the score and I step up willingly to re-enter my life. That's the power of being a twice born human. That's the transformative potential, right? And, you know, and again, we see it in our films. We see it in our stories. If you remember that old Robin Williams boarding school teacher movie, the Dead Poets Society, right? There's that scene where he's this inspiring teacher and he totally transforms his young students. And then he gets in trouble because there's a tragedy in the school. And then he's going to get kicked out of the school as the teacher. It's like their best teacher they've ever had. And he takes the fall for some shit that wasn't his responsibility. And then all as the headmaster's coming to yank him out of class, right? All of his students stand up on their desks and they recite the poem that had lit them up. Like, oh, captain, my captain. And they know they're going to catch shit for it. And they know he's a dead man walking, right? But they do it. And there's this transformative power of like, I'm no longer seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, right? I'm standing up for what is right, good, and true. Damn the consequences, And we even see, you know, that's a very friendly little example, right? You see it in Harry Potter, man. You see it in that, like Harry's been banished, right? And his, you know, and the Death Eaters have taken over Hogwarts, and then they roll back into Hogwarts. And they're like, for the final battles, and they're like, who's with us? Who's with us? And even the people who had turned their backs on them, right, step up. They're like, we're fucking with you this time all the way. Or 300, right? That's that Spartan movie, right? Where they're like, there's only 300 of us. We're fucked, man. Xerxes has like 10,000 or 100,000 Persian warriors. We're smoked. There's no way we get out of this alive. However, we are going to fight at Thermopylae to buy time for the rest of our people.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where he says his famous thing of like, you know, like if there's that many arrows coming at us, then today we shall fight in the shade. Right.
Even or, like with what's happening in Ukraine, I feel like, you know, young kids or people that don't even live in Ukraine now are going back to their countries to fight for a war that they're clearly outnumbered.
Right.
It's there's real life examples of it, which is very inspiring.
Well, and Zelensky, right? I mean, very, very specifically, his today we will fight in the shade was when the U.S. offered him a helicopter evac in week one. And he said, I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. Right? And that moment literally like pivoted NATO. It was one Instagram post from that guy. And he's socially media savvy. You know, he had some deep self-awareness and kind of awareness of global media and how these things work these days. But when he said that, within 72 hours, all the major NATO nations were stroking checks and shipping armaments and things that they were terrified that that was like crossing some political geopolitical red line. And they're like, oh, fuck it. No, we're backing him now. We can't not, right? We can't not because he had spoken the words of Soul Force. He had spoken the words of a twice born human. Like, I'm a dead man walking, right? The only thing left for me to do is bear witness with courage and truth and dignity. And like that was what MLK unlocked. That was what Gandhi unlocked. It's, you know, everybody talks about Mandela, King, Gandhi, right? And then fill in the blank of whoever your favorites are. But like, there is a reason. And the reason is that they sourced from the better angels of their nature, and they ceased to be trying to seek pleasure and avoid pain. They ceased to be trying to line their own nest.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you think in some way we sorry to interrupt, Jamie. Do you think in some way like we need that conflict, that pain, that obstacle in order to be able to have the meaning? I'm asking because I'm wondering if we're going through this existential crisis because I think like most lower class or middle class even folks are living better than most kings 1,000 years ago. And as a society as a whole and as a population as a whole on Earth, we are living better, right, on average. Do you think it's part of that in that we're not actually facing personal crisis and conflicts in our lives that's bringing out meaning in our everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, I often think of, like, we have a bunch of friends that are sort of evolutionary biologists, right? And one of the things that evolutionary biologists love to map and track is sort of the efficiency calculations of animals, right? So a hummingbird will fly 15 meters, but not 23 meters to get to the nearest patch of nectar. Because if they fly 15, they end up net positive. They drain the nectar, they come back to their nest, and they're like, yay, I won. I got extra credits in the bank. But if I had to fly all the way out to 23, I actually end up underwater. I'm in the hole by the time I've come back. Same with squirrels and nuts and just, you know, anything. And you could make a case that we are calculating animals. And so as long as the easier path is available, we will continue to take it, right? So it's just that. So in some respects, things have to get harder to force us to change or grow. No one changes just for the hell of it. We only change for one of two reasons, and you can make a case they're the same, really, which is a compelling goal or compelling pain. So either I want to be the biggest rock star on the planet, therefore I practice my scales every day, you know, and do whatever, or compelling pain. This hurts too much to stand still. So I must do something else. And, you know, arguably an unfulfilled goal starts to hurt, right? So it's kind of the same thing, right? And it feels to me that's where, you know, like, let's take, you know, a clear and pressing example, like climate right now, right? We've known about this for 50 years. I mean, since the Club of Rome and limits to growth in the early 70s, like we've had, and all the baby boomer generation that were banging the drum on this stuff back in the 70s. Exxon had all the reports by, you know, the late 70s. Like, we've known right. and we've known and we've known, and we haven't chosen to change. And part of that reason is that there's not that our decision making loops, right, are completely out of phase with the time scale of the change of human, basically anthropogenic change, the stuff we've been doing that's shifting things. So when we say, hey, we all need to transition, we need to burn less carbon, we need to consume less stuff, we need to buy less plastic shit from China, whatever, whatever, we need to fly less, all this stuff, no one's going to be willing to do that, right? As long as in the short term, we get a net positive result according to our own ledger. And the two, you know, like in basically fighter combat, military fighter combat, there was this notion that was articulated by an Air Force general decades ago, which was the notion of an OODA loop, which was OODA, observe, orient, decide, act. Mm-hmm. So basically, what the hell's going on? Where am I and what's going on, right? I'm going to make a choice and then I'm going to act on the choice. And the whole idea was, if you can get inside the OODA loop in a dogfight of the bad guy, then you're going to end up behind him like Top Gun and pow, 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 shoot him down. That's the goal. You get inside the opposition's OODA loops, right? But if you think about how do we engage in large scale societal, national, civilizational change right now, our two main OODA loops, how do we do shit, is basically with votes and dollars, right? We either elect people, or we, as consumers, as shareholders, as whomever, you know, basically influence the market. So basically markets and politics. And our OODA loops for politics are 2 to 4 years max, right? That's our cycle of change. And our OODA loops for the market are even shorter, right? It's daily stock prices to quarterly reports. That's kind of it. So if you appoint a CEO who is suddenly not just extracting the most profit for their shareholder value, they get fired. They get run out. And the average term for CEOs has been decreasing radically. It used to be like 4 to 5 years, and now it's like under 18 months. Because it's basically like, suck the marrow out of the economy however you can, or you're out, and we'll put in someone who will. And the same with politicians. You have so many politicians that start out idealistic that want to change the system. And then they realize, oh, shit, I can't win if I don't cozy up to donors to get enough ad spend for the TVs and the social media campaigns. Therefore, I'm beholden to those guys. And therefore, if I do something, if I advance any policy that they disagree with, I get shit canned. Right. And I'll get replaced with someone who will. But with the global crises, and it's not just environmental, right? There's macroeconomic, there's geopolitical, there's a whole host of things that are, you know, blinking red right now. Our OODA loops are months to years, but the challenges we're facing were decades and centuries in the making, and they're going to take decades and centuries to steer. So our OODA loops undo us. So this is, now we're like the dumb squirrel with the nuts. You're like, oh, yeah. Like we can't make the, we're not evolutionarily adapted to think in terms of decades and centuries. We're only wired to think in terms of me now, and maybe me now and next, and maybe me and mine, my tribe, my people now and next. Mm-hmm. But to think everyone, everywhere, every when breaks our brains. So we keep making really dumb, self-defeating decisions. And it basically means that we are pretty primed at this point. I think it's fair to say, especially with like the recent Supreme Court hamstringing of the EPA, right? We are quite likely to sail off this cliff, no skid marks. Like we're not even breaking, you know, before we're Wile E. Coyote.
Isn't there some truth though? Like, I get that, like, It is hard to, for most people, to think beyond themselves and their community. But isn't there some sense of like, if everyone can take care of themselves and their community, at least as a whole, that will be a much better place? Like, isn't it better to, you know, if a plane's going down, to take care of yourself first and then take care of the person next to you? What are some of the things that people can do in the near future around just being able to find more meaning for themselves and for their communities?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is super important, and we just kind of alluded to it, right? Like the me now, right? First of all, like I would suggest that like all personal growth, personal optimization, biohacking, the stuff that just kind of has taken up so much of that snake oil marketplace, right? And is trying to sort of fill in the vacuum that organized religion used to offer, right? Is potentially really narcissistic and self-absorbed and conspicuously missing any obvious ethic of care and concern for others beyond myself, and or any imperative for service, which if you think about all ecstatic techniques in the past, they were all within lineages. You had to bow down and you had to, you know, like there was this intergenerational thing you were being invited into. And almost every religious institution and organization worldwide for time immemorial had a very strong element of service attached. This isn't about you, Cupcake, right? The least of my brothers and sisters, some form of charity and forgiveness and social commitment. So, but rather than dismissing all the personal optimization, I think you just need to put it in its right place, which is, I have to have a full tank, right? Of love, vitality, rest, health, right? Awareness to be halfway decent to the people I love, right? If I'm depressed, if I'm an insomniac, if I'm malnourished, if I'm ill, I'm not going to be much use. In fact, someone might have to look after me. So the whole point of personal optimization is fill up your tank. And if you've got enough, then you can love and care for and serve your family. And if your family unit is stable and thriving and you collectively have enough, then you can love and serve your community. And if your community is thriving, then your country and then the world. And there is that time scale that goes on it, right? If I get hit on the head with a hammer or kicked in the balls, right? Suddenly it's back to the bottom of the slide and it's like me now gasping for breath, right? If I have juice and I can start caring, then it's me and mine, like my evolutionarily encoded kin. That's who I care about, right? That's how we're hardwired to care, is family preservation first. And then it's me and mine now. And then if we are stable, then it's me and mine now. And next, I get to strategize about keeping this cool little family unit thriving through the next hazards and obstacles. And then if I get fully juiced, vitalized, and aligned, right? Then I can be thinking about everyone everywhere. Okay, now I care about brown people speaking different languages, worshiping different gods halfway around the world. Why? Because they're people, for God's sake, right? And they deserve it. So then it's everyone everywhere. And then it might even become, on the time scale, everyone. What is this human experience? How many sacrifices did our ancestors make to get us to now? And then also, and there's lots of increasing research on this as people are talking about, you know, civilizational collapse, but possible extinction events. There's this question of like, oh my gosh, if we bugger this up, right? If we shit the bed right now, we're not just losing 8 billion people. We're losing the hundreds of billions of people that have yet to be born. So we have this profound obligation, right, to figure it out, not just to save our own bacon, right, but on behalf of all of our descendants yet to be. There's a beautiful Kierkegaard, you know that YouTube channel, Kierkegaard, I was probably buggering up the pronunciation, but it's that German channel. They have millions and millions of views. They do those super fun kind of cartoony animations, and they're always explaining like physics and wild ass concepts, but they do it in a really friendly, relatable way. And one of their most recent ones was, is this the end of humanity? And so they briefly talk about, you know, current crises, but then they do this thought experiment as to, well, what happens if we figure it out? And what happens if we continue to thrive and grow on this planet? What happens if we move out to the moon or to Mars? What happens if we become an interstellar species? And how many more humans are yet to be born? So rather than thinking of us, of ourselves at the end of the human story, like, oh no, it's collapse and we're unwinding, it's like, actually, we could be at the very beginning. And how does that shift our perspective? And how does that galvanize our courage and our willingness to sacrifice and endure and do some hard shit? Because humans have always had to do hard shit, except lately in the developed world, because we got lucky and won the lottery, right? And it kind of just recontextualizes ourselves and puts us in the big arcs of history and gives us a point beyond pursuing our own hashtag best life.
Yeah, it's a counterintuitive way to think, I feel. Like, I wonder if ancestors hundreds or even thousands of years ago were also thinking that this is their last generation that's going to survive on this earth and that the end of the world is near. I would imagine it's more than ever because they were going through like real wars and they probably didn't even know how many humans or how big the world was. And I wonder if that's just wired in our psychology because people were dying at fairly young ages because of wars and stuff like that. And we're just not wired to think so far ahead that it's our natural inclination just to think this might be the end. They can't really see further ahead beyond kind of what they see in front of them.
Well, I mean, that's an intriguing question. And there's two forks to it that we can take. I mean, one is, and obviously this is definitely true in Korean culture, Japanese culture, Greek culture. I mean, really, arguably all around the world, again, except for lately in the developed West, is huge traditions of ancestor worship. Right. So always explicitly praying to them, making sacrifices, observing ceremonies, speaking and communicating with them, living on their behalf. Right. So in that respect, I think there's always been a much more stable downlink to our lineage. Right. And that has been a profound source of grounding and responsibility and continuity over generations. Now, this question of, hey, because I mean, you know, most people will think like, oh, well, this end of the world shit, haven't we already seen that and done that? Hasn't there always been some wacky dude with long hair on the street corner with a clapboard, like ringing his bell, like the end is nigh, sinners repent, it's coming, right? And you can go back through history and you can look at all the examples. But there was this fascinating paper in the MIT Media Review a couple of years ago, which was the intellectual history of that. Right? How have humans thought about potential ends of the world, and how, if has that changed over time? And the answer that this researcher came up with is that yes, there were always those apocalyptic stories in religious traditions, right? They're ubiquitous around the world. You can pick them out, whether it's Ragnarok and or Armageddon or what or the Kali Yuga or whatever it might have been, but they had a very specific position, which is that the world as we know it ends completely. And there is some transubstantiation, there's some phase change into a new world that is divinely ordained, right? That was fundamentally the structure underneath it. But he said, it wasn't until the 18th century that people actually began to conceive of a world that could continue just without us in it. And there were two factors. One was the discovery and the tracking of Halley's Comet. They're like, holy shit, that thing might hit us. And then what would happen then? So Halley's Comet was this big mind bomb. And the other was the early phases of paleontology. They actually started digging up these crazy ass bones that didn't belong to any animal still walking around. And they're like, wait a second. You know, it's like that old police song, right? Hey there, Mr. Brontosaurus, don't you have a lesson for us? You know, you thought your reign would last and last, and now you're a thing of the past, walking in your footsteps. So those two mind fucks in the 18th century kicked off the very beginning of our sort of existential consciousness and awareness. Mm. And it was interesting. There was this French Enlightenment dude, 1803. He wrote a book called The Last Man. It was arguably the first science fiction book ever. And it was the first one to actually deal with the potential extinction of the human race. And he wrote the book and the poor bastard killed himself, right? It was like too much of a psychic burden. He was just alone on the sharp end of thinking about this stuff. And now we're in a different place. Like, what might it mean for the universe? You know, and people will often say that. They're like, the world doesn't need saving. The world's going to do just fine, right? It's humans that need saving. And there is some truth to that. I mean, even things like radioactive half-life of nuclear, you know, waste, right? Like, yeah, it's going to suck for thousands of years, but in Earth time, it's a moment, you know? So how do we orient ourselves in that in a way that both honors our own mortal fleeting lives and the little petty things we care about, you know, like our kids having a happy childhood and getting into the right schools and finding a partner and marrying and just that sense of like forward growth and motion. And how do we also hold what responsibility we can, right, for playing our small part in the little chapter we happen to find ourselves in? Because I think there's a... Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's a big part of our diseases of despair right now. Right? We're all potted plants and we're all wilting. And we're like, this sucks. What's the point? And we have to have something more than our own gratification as a counterbalance to peering over the screaming abyss and going, oh, sweet Jesus. I mean, this was, you know, this was Albert Camus and Sartre. It was all the French existentialists, right? There's, it's not a coincidence that they had their heyday in the aftermath of World War II. They're like, we've seen some shit, and we have seen the darkest, darkest underbelly of the human psyche, right? It's why there was, you know, like there's the prisoner experiment, right? On all of those ones of like, if you put, you know, you make some people prison guards and you make some people prisoners, and then wouldn't you know,
Lombardo or whatever.
Yeah, which has since been disproven and, you know, how highly controversial, and he fudged a lot of the results. But why did he do that study? Why was he compelled to fudge the results? And why did it become such a ubiquitous story that almost everybody knows it, even if they're not in the social sciences? It was because this is like Hannah Arendt. This is like the banality of evil question, which is like Nazi Germany was a mind fuck. People were like, what? Civilized, developed Western people can do this abomination? How? Who are we? And so that's why Arendt's banality of evil / Zimbardo's prison experiment stuck in the 50s and 60s. Is like, oh my gosh, we have to do a serious rethink on what we think is human nature.
Before we run out of time, I just want to touch on the hedonic engineering that you go into. Yeah. I think it's important for kind of circling back to what people can do to take care of themselves and their own communities. Absolutely. Very fundamental things that I want to make sure we go through.
Yeah, absolutely. So the premise of that was sort of, again, back to that notion of what might the blockchain, so just kind of an open source code base that people can use and build and assemble their own lives from. And, you know, I basically discounted most healing and inspiration technologies that are rare, expensive, or complicated. Because at a bare ass minimum, the bottom 4 billion humans in the world will never get to lay their hands on them. So how can we work with stuff that is cheap, accessible, and scalable? That was the design criteria, right? And it really comes down to, wow, the closer we can work to evolutionary drivers, meaning the things that we are genetically primed and encoded to do no matter what, the closer we can work with those things, the more punch they have, right? This is like Archimedes, you know, back in the day where he's like, give me a lever long enough and I can move the world. So evolutionary drivers are the longer levers. And I was thinking about this. The first thing that I twigged onto was breath work. Right. And I was doing breath, you know, free dive breath training with Kurt Crack. He's the kind of world champion instructor and this kind of stuff. And he was basically like, oh, yeah, you know, when you first try and hold your breath for as long as you can and you think you've run out of air, you haven't. You've got at least 40% reserves in your lungs. So you need to, you know, deal with that kind of gulping involuntary breath movement and just understand it's not the red alert signal your brain thinks it is. Right. So we were always wired to have safety reserves in our breathing. Right. And then you take it further and you realize that if I breathe deeply or I breathe slowly or I hyperventilate, all these things change my blood chemistry and neurochemistry. And they radically shift my states of consciousness. If I'm stressed, I can calm down. If I'm flat, I can power up. And if I'm, you know, and if I choose to via hyperventilation and other more complex breath work, I can even wildly shift my state into visionary states. So I can completely change just with breathing. Right? That's powerful. So you're like, okay, respiration. If we don't breathe, we die. It's got huge amounts of encoding. And if we learn to jimmy with it, if we learn to tinker with it, we have access to a whole wider range of consciousness. Awesome. Right? The next would be sexuality. Right? And it's titillating, it's taboo, it's got all these things around it. But you're just like, look, for millions of years, you know, all vertebrates, including, you know, mammals, including primates, including us, right, had to procreate with no user manual. No Pornhub, no Kama Sutra, no handbooks, right? We just figured out how to put our bits together and make babies. And that's, if you just think about that for a second, it's not a dead simple or obvious logistical act, right? We figured out how to do it anyway, which means that all of the incentives and all of the instructions were just basically genetic and hormonal. Now that by itself, the key there is like evolution is amoral. Evolution does not care about us standing in front of an altar saying "Till death do we part." Evolution does not care about romance, you know, or our pledges or our promises. Evolution will just constantly, all it wants to do is shake up the genetic snow globe and get as robust and varied a gene pool as possible. And it incense jealousy and infidelity and, you know, and all of these things, because it wants something different than what we want. And it wins. Right? It just tends to win. And so there's a real empowerment there, which is like, if you just think of sexual fitness, how might we, and you know, John Lilly back in the day, the infamous NIH brains neuroscientist and researcher who then got into invented float tanks, did LSD and ketamine research, went way off the deep end with dolphins, like that guy, back in 1953 mapped primate nervous systems and ecstatic circuitry. And he's like, oh, humans' ecstatic circuitry maps one-to-one with our sexual arousal network. No surprise, because evolution is efficient. And that was the most important job one, but it's also our entire ecstatic nervous system. So if you engage in sexual fitness practices, of which there's, you know, abundant amounts, but you consider it just like you would yoga or flossing your teeth or jogging or running, like that is an incredibly potent means of biohacking. And then you can get into just general embodiment, and specifically, you know, it's getting a lot more airplay these days, but fundamentally vagal nerve and vagal nerve tone, and how much that's a giant metronome for our body and our health and vitality. And you can shift and, you know, do it by gargling, by singing, by gagging and choking. You can do it by massage and pressure points. There's, you know, there's high-tech versions like implanted pacemakers that send a little electrical stimulation into our vagal nerve. There's high-tech, but the low-tech absolutely works also. And the endocannabinoid system, which is fundamentally where cannabis fits in, but it's not about cannabis. Right. I mean, the endocannabinoid system was in sea sponges 500 million years ago. It just happens that this little five-fingered weed happens to fit into that brain system lock and key, but it engages everything from traumatic brain injury to the erasure of traumatic memories, right, to anxiety. It's anandamide is our endogenous bliss chemical, and it plays a huge role in health, well-being, vitality, and inflammation, and a host of other things. So just those two, understanding how they work in our body and optimizing them, huge boost in resiliency, ability to mend and heal, ability not to have obsessive, anxious thoughts, and to generally feel equanimity, like I'm okay and the world's okay.
Jamie, then, you mentioned gagging and choking. I have to ask, how is that related to the embodiment part?
Well, it's pretty embodied, right? I mean, fundamentally, right? Back to Ernest Becker, he's like to what is he says this funny ass thing. He's like to gaze upon another human face and experience the mysterium tremendum, like the great mystery, right? Of like, here we are, sort of almost like divine form, and connect that to an anus that shits. He goes, it's too much. I can't handle it. And the poets and, you know, the gods laugh and the poets live in torture. And you're like, whoa, that's weird. But if you really think about it, right, go wind us way back down the evolutionary tree, right? Lop off our limbs. And we're fundamentally worms with mouths, spinal columns, and assholes. And that whole spasming, trembling, gagging, sneezing, puking, coming, shitting process, which is, you know, even just saying those words in sequence, it's like, a little cringe, right? You're like, that's actually how our bodies work. And like Robert Sapolsky, the Stanford neuroscientist, I mean, he wrote a book of like why zebras don't get ulcers. And the general premise was, is that animals tend not to hold on to stress and trauma. They will go through a, you know, the lion is chasing us at the watering hole, whatever. And they will quite often like shiver and shake and like, and get it out. And they're done. They've flushed their system and they've returned back to equilibrium. Like we're driving back on our commute. We're staying up at night. We're hate tweeting somebody. We ruminate on this shit and it pickles us from the inside and out. So if you think about a lot of healing modalities, whether it's EMDR, like eye movement, whether it's tongue and mouth movement, whether it's tremor release therapies where, you know, you might do like an isometric hold, like a wall squat or a bridge until your muscles fatigue to the point where they start vibrating and oscillating, primal scream, all these things, we're all just trying to get back to, right? A very primitive discharge of our nervous systems. Even, you know, the current crazes for contrast therapy, intermittent fasting, like so hot and cold, right? Ice baths and saunas. We're just trying to recreate what it meant to be a hunter-gatherer for 100,000 years. We're sometimes super fucking cold, and we're sometimes sweating balls. And that's probably better than 72 degrees climate control all the time. Intermittent fasting. Sometimes I binge, sometimes I fast, right? Versus having 10,000 calories of high fructose corn syrup and refined food in a refrigerated box right across from the couch at all times. So we are trying to intuitively reintroduce the range of consciousness, of neurophysiological set points. And the wider we expand that, generally speaking, the higher our health and resiliency. So the gagging and choking just happens to be forces, you know, factors or reflex responses that I, like if you've ever, you know, I mean, Anil Seth at Princeton has talked about, you know, the idea of going to the bathroom, right? And taking a big long dump. And then he says, and that will often press on the base of the vagus nerve. And it actually creates goosebumps, drop in blood pressure, and euphoria, which he then playfully calls poophoria, right? If anybody's ever been hammered at a party or sick, and you're leaning over the toilet, puking your guts out, and like your eyes are watering, and you're like, and you kind of come up for air, and you're like, oh my gosh. And if you weren't like so nauseous because you just drank something you shouldn't have, right? You quite often feel like a level set. Or when you were a kid and you just had a bawling cry, like shaking, spasming, you know, and then afterwards you're like, oh, I kind of feel good now. I kind of feel like just curling up with my teddy bear and taking a nap. Like those are deep body brain resets. And we have access to all of those. And if you, instead of having them be accidental and traumatic, if you actually work them into a reliable practice, we can discharge trauma. And we can mend as we go. And so our capacity, right, to hold more and endure more goes up. And then the final two, because we were talking about all five, right? So we had respiration, sexuality, embodiment. And then the final two are kind of like turbo buttons. And that's music and substances, right? And so music, you can basically just say, I mean, and everybody knows this, right? Like good tunes make the world go around. And there's all kinds of studies on like high BPM music, typically like 120 beats a minute. And up, you increase your output for weightlifting. You can go longer on cardio things like treadmills and Stairmasters, right? And you know, you look back to chain gangs, look back to rowing galleys of like Vikings in their longboats, like chanting, rhythmic. Like if you have a shared soundscape, right, you can do more and it hurts less, basically. And Daniel Levitin at McGill University did some great studies and made the case that music potentially predates language as a tool of civilization. So like, you know, the earliest bone flutes are like 50,000 years old. And he's like, yeah, we didn't start with bone flutes. We almost certainly started with some form of hollow log drum, percussion, skin hoop drums, whatever. So like we were creating the pulse of life, right? Yeah. And we were using it to coordinate humans and to drop us into trance states or coherent states. Robin Dunbar at Oxford, the famous for the Dunbar number, has done similar studies with the San Bushmen and the Kalahari. He's like, hey, interestingly, when the tribe is at their worst, they hold more trance dances. They literally not less. They don't wait for things to be groovy to then throw a party. They throw parties when they're at each other's throats. Because the notion of getting into rhythmic movement and rhythm together is actually a way to discharge, right, a lot of the frictions and tensions. So you're like, okay, music, awesome. And then definitely throw in contemporary high-tech, high-amplitude sound. Mm. Like if anybody has been to a good club or a good show with a ultra-high fidelity sound system like a Function One, which is really pristine, no distortion, you're like, oh, and especially with like futuristic, crazy EDM sounds that, you know, no instrument on earth has ever made, you're like, oh, I'm not listening to music, right? This isn't like me driving down the road in a car singing along to Katy Perry. I'm experiencing an acoustic water pick from my soul, right? I mean, there are these frequencies of like trebles, highs, basses that are just moving through my body.
Yeah.
And they have this powerful impact. So music, right? Huge.
What's the genres that you recommend, or do you have any specific artists or playlists that you recommend? And are these good music to listen to like in the background when you're working as well? Mm.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I wrote Recapture the Rapture during lockdown, during COVID, and the book had been delayed. And then my editor was like, oh no, we're not delaying it anymore. You have 5 months to submit the manuscript. And I'm like, oh shit, right? So I got Bose noise canceling headphones. I got some shade grown organic coffee. I got 2 milligram Lucy nicotine gum. Cause again, Andrew Huberman was like, nicotine is one of the baddest ass cognitive enhancers. Just don't get hooked on cigarettes. Mm. Right. And I put on Brain FM, which is kind of a binaural beaty thing, but it's kind of next gen. It's not the sort of fruity 70s and 80s tech. And I would just put it on. I'd drink my pint of coffee. I'd pop in 2 milligrams of gum and I would just disappear for 3 to 4 hours into a focused creative flow state. And I wrote 120,000 words, which is basically like a, you know, close to a 500-page book in my 5 months.
It's like 3 books.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I overwrote. I had to edit the hell out of it, drop a ton of stuff. But yeah, just massive, massive output.
Wow.
Music is essential for priming a state. I would say that my favorite genres, I mean, one, mostly lyricless, high-end, functional EDM, my personal favorites involve some forms of string and musical percussion and instrumentation, plus potentially ethereal female voices. To me, that's just kind of a sweet spot. Mm. So Yaima is beautiful. Emancipator is beautiful. Desert Dwellers has a ton of some really good beats.
Gelka. So less lyrics, you're saying, more beats.
Well, that would be in the deeply transcendent space. Right. And then there's kind of almost the exact opposite, which goes back to soul force, which goes back to embracing the brokenness of the human condition, which is the sort of the arcana Americana, like in the American songbook, is this sort of secret hidden tradition. And we all know it because they're always the songs that everybody lights their lighters or holds up their phones for, right? And there's a church of Beyonce in San Francisco that like does the Grace Cathedral Church on Wednesdays actually holds a service based on Beyonce bangers. Right, like I'm a survivor. You know, you've got Lady Gaga, right? You've got contemporary expressions of this. You've got African slave spirituals. You've got jazz, blues, gospel, right? You've got these traditions that are based in the brokenness of the human experience, right? And then triumphant redemption, you know. And what I think is so powerful about those songs is that almost to a one, the ones that really move us start out of testaments of woe. I've been down so goddamn long, right? It seems like up to me. And everyone's like, yes, preach. I can feel that in my own life, right? And then they get rising to this triumphant chorus of like, yes, all that has happened and we are still rising up singing, right? We are celebrating, not bypassing this human experience, right? But embodying it and expressing it. In it with a degree of persistence, with a degree of courage, and then beauty and grace, because, oh, by the way, I'm wailing with it, right? And that to me is some of the most, you know, that's our essential scripture. So if we were talking about like, what does meaning 3.0 look like? And how do we do this without tops down, somebody telling us what to believe, somebody telling us which stories are approved, somebody telling us how we ought to live our lives, right? My sense is that like the American songbook, right, of those redemption songs, Bob Marley, right, like is another one. I mean, you take your pick, Johnny Cash, like they show up, Dolly Parton, they show up in country, blues, gospel, jazz. You know, we they're all over the place. And what's so beautiful about it is that like that tradition is no longer just American, right? It belongs to the world, and arguably, those redemption songs, they're not just about redeeming the harsh unpredictability of the human experience and testifying, right, which is gorgeous, right? But they also redeem this whole fucked up American experience in history, the legacy of conquest, right? Genocide and slavery, right? Like, because like many folks in the social justice space these days are just bummed out to the point of bitter, right? The 1619 Project and the New York Times, all these things are like, hey, man, the original sin of this country has been genocide and slavery. Like, we are tainted. This is wrong. And I would say almost the exact opposite is like, look, all that injustice happened, all that blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, think about, you know, everything from Vietnamese boat people to Chinese rail workers to Irish potato famine to Cherokee Trail of Tears to West African slave diaspora, right, to Jews coming over post-Holocaust, right? Like this country is a melting pot of human suffering, right, that has also created profound grace and profound testaments of revival. So it's on us to like dust those gems off, man. They were forged right under intense pressures at the price of, you know, thousands, millions of our ancestors? And can we actually honor all of that sacrifice, right? By carrying these redemption songs forward.
Yeah. What strikes me about the five things you mentioned around breathing, music, sexuality, substances, and embodiment, it's all around being so present in the moment. Like when I'm breathing, I'm only focusing on my breathing. When I'm in the music, I'm really present. Same with sex, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is it arguable that a lot of what you're mentioning around meaning 3.0 and finding that meaning is actually not about finding the meaning? Because when I'm present in the moment, I'm not thinking about the meaning of life. I'm not thinking about the things that are happening or how I'm just really in that moment. And it seems like, well, a lot of what you're suggesting is putting people in that state.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, that's why Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now became a multi-million copy bestseller, right? Yeah. But I think actually it's subtler and more complicated than that. Because
I'm sure, yeah.
Because basically, and funnily enough, I mean, this is where I booted out of academia. I wrote a PhD dissertation prospectus called Towards a Polychronic Quantum Epistemology. Like, how do we look at time and space and us and history? Right. And we really do it in, like, we are a diachronic society. We're linear, right? Past, present, future, and hustle, hustle, hustle to get to what's next. Right. And that leaves us, if we're always thinking about what's next and we're never thinking about what's now, then we're robbed of the richness of this moment. Right. And that's Protestant work ethic. That's the old Hebrew alpha and omega, time's arrow versus, like, you know, Ouroboros, circular time. Right. Then there's synchronic time. So that's diachronic time. Then there's synchronic time, which is the power of now. There's only this moment. Right. And then there is achronic, meaning there's no time at all. So, like, if somebody talks about racism as this timeless thing, it's always been there. That's an achronic perspective. Right. Synchronic might be like, let's look at this little moment in time. It is what it is. What came before doesn't matter. What comes after doesn't matter. And the reality is that part of the reason that the power of now is so seductive for us is because we're missing that nutrient. As a culture, we're terrible at just being. So it's a necessary but not sufficient corrective to linear hustle, hustle, diachronic culture. But it's not sufficient. Because, like, if you think about Eckhart Tolle sitting on his park bench, right? He would have been toast, you know, if someone hadn't come to look after him, even once he was on Oprah and became a big deal. He's got dozens of handlers. I mean, somehow we just stumbled across, like, Facebook ads. And, like, last year, Eckhart Tolle was, like, one of the number one Facebook ad propagation. They had millions of dollars going out through Facebook ads. That's not fucking Eckhart. And if Eckhart gets to sit in his happy place in his power of now, there's tons of people in his organization that are busting their ass inside clock time, right? So it is a balance, right? We have to be able to think of me now and be now, but we also have to think about next. That's Aesop's fable of the ant and the grasshopper, right? And so simply being present with no understanding of what's coming is a fool's errand. Right. But never being present is also a fool's errand. And so the Greeks have that beautiful description of those different types of time, right? They talk about clock time. They call it chronos. Right. And arguably that's the horizontal axis, past, present, future. But then they also talk about this other kind of time, which is where flow states happen, it's where mystical states happen, all those kind of things, which is kairos, sacred time, the timeless. It's forever, always perfect and complete. And goes nowhere. It contains all things in that moment. And esoteric Christianity, right, had, and, you know, not orthodox institutional, but esoteric was like, oh, that's the meaning of the cross, is can you, as a human who's embodied, who's alive, so you're yoked to clock time, chronos, can you also maintain stable access to kairos? And right there at the intersection is what the Rosicrucians, like those of the rosy cross, right, talked about as being fulfilled, being a twice born human, right? Like I am, and, you know, and so it's that sense of, can I be aware of the impossibilities, the grief, the suffering, and the constraints of life on this mortal coil? And at the same time, can I remember the truest and deepest truths of reality and show up, bear witness, testify from that place without wiggling off it.
Yeah, beautiful, Seth. I think that's a beautiful way to close this conversation off, Jamie. Thank you for educating us, inspiring us. I learned a lot just from this conversation. And I would highly recommend people to check out the book, Recapture the Rapture. Obviously, your other book, Stealing the Fire, which is another inspiring book. Where can people find you online and learn more about you?
Yeah, so basically, the flowgenomeproject.com is kind of our home base, and we basically put all of this stuff into practice. So we train leaders and leaders of their own communities. So that's kind of who our community is. It's a group of leaders. So if you are responsible for your own friends, your own family, your own tribe, and you would like to have a place where you can swap notes and learn and train with other folks, that's kind of what we're here to do. And we're also, you know, Flow Genome on Instagram, Facebook, et cetera. And feel free to drop by, say hi.
There's also a quiz on the site. I remember taking it like a year ago, right? Don't you guys have a quiz that everyone can take? Is that useful?
Yeah, we love trying to teach, you know, as we go. So the Flow Profile is one of our largest.
That's it. Yeah.
Probably 250,000 people have taken it. And it's a diagnostic of how do you most naturally get into flow states. And there's also, you know, a bunch of others that are sort of, you know, breadcrumbs to the doorstep of getting serious about leveling up.
Yeah, the Flow Profile is the one that I was thinking about. Yeah, we'll link all that below for people to check out. Jamie, thank you so much for coming on. This has been so inspiring.
For sure, man. And I imagine it was a slight deviation from just tips and tricks and hacks, but hopefully putting it in the broader context of, I think we all want lives that matter. We all want to be significant, and we all want to do the courageous, right thing. So putting it in that bigger perspective, I hope actually gives us reason to get out of bed in the morning and actually do our tips and tricks and hacks, but just from a slightly bigger perspective of what is it all for?
Yeah, I think the tips and tricks is the easier path that people want and that we could have gone, but I'm glad we went more of this high level perspective for people to help reshape their thinking as a whole. I think that was really important.
Beautiful. Well, great to connect, Sean.
Awesome. Thanks, Jamie.
Cheers.
Thanks for making it all the way to the end of the show. Hope you really enjoyed our guest today and that you took one thing valuable from our conversation. If you haven't already, I would love it if you could leave a quick rating or review on whichever network you're listening to the show and share this episode with one friend if you found it valuable. And if it's something that a friend, a family member, or just someone that you care about could find a little bit of insight from what you learned today. All right. Ciao.